Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Gail Sylvia, and you're listening to SylviaGlobal.com. My special guest this afternoon is an incredible woman of influence, foresight, and wisdom. Her name is Tiffany. Oh, my gosh, Tiffany, I just lost your name, just like your last name, just that quick. Dufu, I'm sorry. Thank you so much. Tiffany Dufu, president of the White House Project. She is there in New York. I am here in California. And, Tiffany, we have women at the AWID conference in Turkey who are listening in on our discussion today. These women are looking for information about how the White House Project model can be used in their countries and learn more about the efforts and diversity of women who are being developed through this pipeline of elected officials leading from local levels, grassroots levels, all the way up to the White House. Thank you, Tiffany, for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Tiffany, can you give our listeners some background in terms of why the White House Project was founded and what the need is in the United States that continues to justify its importance?
Absolutely. The White House Project was founded in 1998 by Marie Wilson, who is former president of the Ms. Foundation. And she founded the White House Project after years of working to advance women and girls in this country and really coming to an epiphany that, you know, if we just got more women in charge, we might be able to do this work of advancing women and girls much more efficiently. Across all 10 sectors of our society, women are leading at the highest levels at about 16-17%, according to the latest numbers, which is pretty appalling when you think about the fact that we're over half of the population. Just in politics alone, the United States currently ranks 93rd in the world in terms of women's political leadership and representation. And so the White House Project...
Let me stop you for a second. We rank as a nation where?
93 now.
We rank in 93.
Yes,
in terms
I know.
Of the presence of women in elected office?
Yes, that's right, in parliaments across the world, which means that, yes, it's a very startling number. People are often very surprised to hear that the leading democracy falls so low on this global scale, which is why, to your question, the White House Project exists. We believe that when all levels of leadership are diversified with women equipped to lead in the 21st century, and, you know, to the credit, when we're diversified across the board with underrepresented people, but our work, of course, is around women, that we will be able to create much more better and innovative solutions that will impact all of us. We know that this world is really dealing with some pretty big challenges, and we believe that more diverse perspectives sitting at the table is going to help to get us to better outcomes, and that's why we're so committed to making sure that the pipeline is filled with really dynamic women.
I know that in May the 3rd through the 5th, you will be one of the leaders of a workshop for the Women's Funding Network in Los Angeles,
yes,
where more than 164 different women's funds and other supporters will be present. You're going to be doing a workshop called Engaging New Audiences in Political Leadership. How does that information fit into the model of the White House Project, given the diversity of women ethnically and economically?
Absolutely. We're very happy to be a part of the Women's Funding Network conference in a couple of weeks. The White House Project currently ignites the leadership of women in business and politics. So we coach, connect, and educate an ever-expanding alumni network of 14,000 women who's growing every day, and that's in the U.S. The focus is on women who are aged 21 to 35. So these are women who are of the millennial generation, a few Gen X, and we really are focused on activating the ambition and the creativity and the skills necessary for their innovative and effective leadership. Over half of our alum base are women of color. 40% are low income. So the White House Project has, since our inception, been very committed to diversity when it comes to filling the leadership pipeline. And we've been successful at recruiting so many women in part because we're very committed to meeting them where they are at. So we're able to identify what women really care about in their communities and then really encourage them to think about their leadership advancement as a strategic option to really enacting the change that they want to see in the world.
Does your focus mean that women who are over 35 are excluded?
What it means is that all women are welcome to come to the White House Project programs. We focus on women early in their careers because we've done some work and some research in looking at those 14,000 alum and recognizing that those among them who were the superstars, so those women out of the 14,000 that have been the most effective at advancing their leadership, possess some really key leadership assets that make them propel their leadership forward faster. And what we found is that for this demographic of women in particular, they're just fundamental leadership assets. It's all about political savvy, around being effective storyteller, really understanding your own viability, that regardless of whether or not they want to lead in politics or business or social entrepreneurship or the nonprofit sector, they're going to need an order for them to be effective. It's possible that women later in their lives and in their careers have already amassed this knowledge and information, which is part of the reason why they've been successful. If for any reason they have not, the White House Project is absolutely where they should be, and we're committed to advancing their leadership.
What walk us through an example of what the White House Project program consists of when a participant arrives from the, and take us from the beginning, how a listener would actually apply and connect and graduate.
Yes, absolutely. So one of our alums is a woman named Leah Webb. Leah was in upstate New York. She's a healthcare worker, very concerned about the rates of obesity in her community and the healthcare disparities. There was a Popeye's chicken in her community. There was a McDonald's, but there was not a grocery store. And she believed that if her residents had access to fresh food, they would be able to be healthier. There hadn't been a grocery store within the city limits in 15 years. Leah wanted to do something about this, and so she began to advocate, particularly at city council meetings, about how they needed a grocery store in the community. But nothing was happening, and an organizer from the White House Project learned about Leah Webb. We have our tentacles in many communities across the country and are constantly asking our partner organizations to help us identify the women on the ground who really could make a bigger impact if we could help them to advance their leadership. And Leah was a woman who was identified as such. She reluctantly came to a White House Project training when we first told her there was going to be an open seat and that we thought that she should run for office. She balked, which is what most women do when you first propose this idea or this notion of them running for office. But she came. We found other people in her network who could encourage her and call her and suggest that she run. And she went through a few different leadership development modules. The first was one that really focuses on fundraising. We have one that focuses on community organizing. We have another that focuses on communications. She also got connected to an alumni network. Remember those 14,000 women across the country at the local level who could help her to advance her leadership. And long story short, she ran. She won. She was the first African-American and the youngest woman to ever sit on the city council in her city, and within 2 years she broke ground on a grocery store on a Save-A-Lot, which was the first one that her city had seen in over 17 years. So, you know, the whole point of the White House Project is that women often have really great ideas about how to make the world a better place, but few of them are really making the investment in their leadership that they need to in order for those to actually happen. And so we do training, and we also have Go Connect networking events to help them along the way.
Where does the resistance come from and the fear?
From women or from our society?
From women in general.
Yeah.
You know, that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, women are typically not socialized to feel comfortable declaring their ambition in a real public way. This is part of the reason why we started with politics and advancing women's leadership, because if you can train and prepare a young woman to have the communication skills, the fundraising skills, the organizing skills, to be able to run and win for elective office, which really requires herself putting herself out there, really taking a risk and declaring her ambition in a public way, she can do just about anything after that. We are socialized to be performers, to really put our head down, achieve really great results, and really are taught as girls that if we do this, we can really, we'll be successful. And what happens is, for many women, we can get through our academic careers brilliantly with this strategy. But once we get out into, you know, what we often call the real world, we find out that performance does matter, but there are other aspects of leadership like visibility and voice that also matter as well. And then understanding the system that you're in, the environment that you're in, and being able to navigate that is critical to advancing your leadership. One of our alums that I had the pleasure of speaking to when we were really looking at our superstars, you know, she says to me, Tiffany, some of my friends, you know, they don't understand. They don't want to play politics. They feel like it's a dirty game. They don't want to get engaged. But they don't understand that if they're a member of a family, they've been playing politics their entire life. And that if they want to be successful, they always are going to have to be able to navigate the politics of their environment. So those are some of the barriers and fears really around risk-taking and not wanting to take them, and around not declaring our ambitions publicly.
You know, you were recognized among women in history during Women's History Month, along with a stellar group of women from Gloria Steinem to Hillary Clinton. And in that blog by Marlo Thomas, there's a quote from Sheryl Sandberg on her Facebook page, that we're not teaching our girls and women to have professional ambitions. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not encouraging them to lean into their careers and aim for powerful jobs. With only 3% of Fortune 500 companies run by women, we have a real problem. Mm-hmm. This sounds like it applies equally as well, if not more, to the political arena and the mission of the White House project, correct?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, one of the things about women is that we have to make investments in things that really matter to us. We don't often look at ourselves in the mirror and say, oh, I see a senator here in the making. So I think that, you know, it's beholden upon institutions and on culture to create environments where women can really bring their full selves to the table, and also where we can really tap into what women care about and what matters to them. But I think it's also beholden on women, which in some ways is what Cheryl, you know, often refers to, that we really understand that we're the most powerful change agents in our own journey, and that we also have a responsibility to play in our leadership advancement, not just for us, not just for our families, but for our communities and for the entire planet.
You know, just like running a business, being in politics is not for the weak or the weary. The characteristics, some of the characteristics of women and men as well, is that, you know, we're ambitious. But when we're, as females, being ambitious is also considered being aggressive and assertive and wanting to be in control, and it can lead to, you know, a really uncomfortable place if it's not encouraged and supported at home as well. You mentioned institutions and women supporting one another, but what can parents do within their own home environments, parents, both parents, and relatives, male and female, do to nurture a positive self-image around women who are ambitious?
Absolutely. What a wonderful question. You know, I think the best way to answer that is to just talk a little bit about my upbringing, because my parents did actually a really great job of cultivating that ambition in me without necessarily realizing it. One of the things that my dad did, in part because he was really committed to this old Greek model of leadership where, you know, you acknowledge where you stand and deliver in front of people, he was always pushing us to engage in activities where we had to speak in front of people. And so one of the things he encouraged us to do was to get involved in student government. So even in elementary school, I was running for office and was a student leader. And this gave me two experiences that women need more of in order to be able to draw their ambition out of themselves and really leverage it to propel their leadership. The first is that running for office at a very young age gave me lots of practice failing publicly. You know, I didn't always win, but when I lost, everyone knew it. And I had to come to school the next day knowing that everyone knew that I lost. And I had to develop the kind of resiliency that comes from public failure. And because we often are conditioned to be perfectionists and to not want to, you know, show our hand, public failure is not something that women are often used to and also that we're not forgiven for. But I think lots of practice in that really encourages us to be able to take risks. The other aspect of my ambition that was fueled by that early experience was that I got lots of practice asking people to make an investment in me and my leadership. I was constantly asking for people to vote for me and having to make a case as to why someone should invest in me. And again, we see women so often who are really wonderful performers, they achieve great results, and yet they have the most difficult, challenging time asking other people to invest in them. Now, they don't have a hard time asking people to invest in their children or their communities or their organizations or the things that they care about. Women are some of the best sales people and negotiators that one could possibly imagine, but usually not for themselves and on behalf of themselves. And this is really important in terms of cultivating ambition in girls very early on, is encouraging them to take risks, encouraging them to fail publicly, and giving them lots of practice with asking people to make an investment in them.
Tiffany, I think that that's absolutely accurate. I know from my own experience that overcoming tremendous shyness and being, actually I used to be introduced by my grandmother as she has three granddaughters and two grandsons, and I'm actually the second from the oldest. And she used to say, oh, this is my grandson Alan, this is my granddaughter Barbara, this is my granddaughter Joyce, my grandson William, oh, and this is my other granddaughter Timid, and that would be me. And, you know, going through that and trying internally at a very young age, young being elementary age, to want to break out of the shyness and not to have it hold me back from wonderful life experiences, and not to be viewed by someone I love so dearly, my grandmother, as she would do that in order to instill a very important message in me, and that was, it's up to me to accept my position and mm-hmm. to know my worth.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found continues to happen, and even again, just pointing to Sheryl Sandberg's comment, she put it simply, and I'm quoting her, I want my daughter to have the choice not to just succeed, she says, but to be liked for her accomplishments, end quote. And I think that unlike boys and men, women want to be liked. And so even within her her comment, there's still this element that I'm sensing, and I'll have to get Sheryl on the show, this element that I'm sensing that distinguishes us in this, there at the cellular level, you know, mm-hmm. that there's these things internally within females that go beyond just our societal and our cultural roles, but somehow there's this message that being liked is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see or observe that as being an equally important quality in men. And I have sons and nephews and uncles and brothers, and they want to, you know, they're congenial and they get along, but being liked is something that causes them to look at me cockeyed. how did that factor in your own, you know, years of growing up and learning to win and lose, which was very valuable insight. How does being liked factor into your own development?
Yeah, you know, it's so it's so interesting that you ask that. I was telling this story at our Epic Awards recently. I was getting up on the stage, and I had this moment where I just started cracking up laughing, because right in that moment, I went back to this time when I was in high school. I was trying to convince my best friend to come out of the bathroom stall that she had locked herself into. And she was mortified because just moments earlier she had reached over in class to pick up her pencil off of the floor, and this little sock that she had stuffed in her bra came out onto the floor and everyone saw it, and so she ran to the bathroom. And at the end of my, you know, rousing speech to try to get her to come out of the bathroom, I said to her, "I know it sounds crazy right now, but one day people will appreciate that we're smart and that we want to do good things in the world and that we have important things to say." I said, "One day that will be so cool." And I meant it with all sincerity, you know, right then, because it was that moment in adolescent life, especially for girls, where you just want to be accepted so much by others. And the thought of not being literally would drive you to the bathroom, you know, to lock yourself in there. And, of course, she is.
And how did she respond?
Oh, gosh. She stopped crying right at that moment at the end of my speech. She opened up the bathroom door and she looked at me and said, "Yeah, right, Tiffany. And we'll still have to have big boobs."
You know, the other part of it that could be added to that is we have to also not always take ourselves so seriously.
That's right.
Because I find that in those moments when we take ourselves too seriously, then we place added pressure on ourselves that can be weightier than anything that comes externally.
That's
and
right.
Being able to laugh at ourselves is one of the not only a defense mechanism that, you know, that provides some sanity in moments like that, but it also seems at a cellular level to assure us of being healthy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And remaining humble, because leadership and humility are generally two words that get confused. Can you speak to that part around leadership and humility and how that is reflected in the women, you know, over the 14,000 alumni that have come through the White House Project Network?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, what you're really hitting on, especially when you say the word humility, is an aspect of leadership that we have found absolutely essential in inspiring the next generation of women leaders, particularly, which is this whole notion of authenticity. You know, young people today, anyone, but particularly young people, they can smell misalignment from a mile away. And they don't trust it. They don't want to have anything to do with it. And what, you know, I have personally found, even in this, you know, 15 months of leading the White House Project, is that the exercise of leadership is such a practice in really taking a look in the mirror. It's such a practice in exercising your own integrity, because the leadership, which is, you know, this process of enabling others to achieve a shared purpose in the face of uncertainty, only happens when people trust you and when you can provide a vision that people will want to own and people will want to get behind. And the authenticity and the humility that comes with that is absolutely essential. And it is the breakdown and the disconnect between leadership and humility and authenticity that is actually plaguing leadership in some ways in our country today. And it's part of the reason why there's often an enormous amount of cynicism, you know, when it comes to leadership, particularly political leadership. So I think it's important, very important.
Tiffany, can you speak to understanding your own viability and being an effective storyteller? What did you mean by this?
So, you know, what's so interesting is, you know, for so long at the White House Project, we really focused on Marion Wright Edelman's quote, "You can't be what you can't see." And part of our framework really involves having panels and presenting models of leadership that our women who are very diverse can resonate with. So we intentionally have women who have been in office before, who are in leadership, who reflect the diversity of the women in the room, come to them so they can ask them questions and so that they can literally imagine themselves to be the kind of leaders that we know that they can be. What was so powerful about studying our superstars over this past year is that they were really able to activate their own imagination to really inspire themselves to believe that they could be the leaders that they wanted to be. In some cases, whether they had that role model or not, it was a very strong sense of, I can do this. This is my calling. This is what I was called to do, and I can be it. So that very, very strong sense of viability, which particularly in the political world is quite remarkable because we have our own traditional notions of what it means to be a viable candidate. And so many of these women defy those odds and defy that stereotype of what it means to be viable. Storytelling is also an essential part of advancing your leadership, regardless of who you are. What we found were that our superstars were very effective at weaving their personal narrative into an ask so that you really felt beholden and inspired to want to share in their leadership success. It's no wonder that they had really encouraged and were successful at cultivating relationships with mentors, with sponsors, with people in their community. It was as if their leadership advancement was a team sport, and they were the coach, and they had to have their stories to really rile up their team and to get their bench ready to go in helping them to get to where they wanted to be. But storytelling was, interestingly enough, a really compelling part of why these women were so successful.
Tell us your story, Tiffany, your background as it relates to generations before you, your mother's influence, your father's influence, your grandmother's influence. Will you share some of that story with our listeners so that they can understand that that this is quite possible for them to achieve at a higher level, whatever level they may be at now, they can always take it up another notch, and that there is no roadmap that excludes anyone when it comes to succeeding.
That's absolutely correct. So my story begins when I was conceived. When my mom found out she was pregnant with me, she was living in Watts, L.A. at the time. That's where she met my dad. That's where they were from. And it was a rough place and it was a rough time. My mom felt strongly that in order to create a new opportunity and a new reality for her family, that they would need to uproot themselves. And so she encouraged my dad, which is probably a diplomatic way of putting it, to join the military. That was the one option that they had at that time. And I was born 9 months later at Fort Lewis Army Base in Tacoma, Washington, and was raised in the Pacific Northwest as a result of my mom's leadership and her foresight. It was not an easy choice. My father is one of 13 children and did not want to leave home. But that decision really was the beginning of my parents teaching me a quote that my dad used to always tell us, which is, "Tiffany, if you want something that you've never had before, you're going to have to do something that you've never done before in order to get it." And my parents were experts at doing new things that they had never done before in order to create new outcomes for their family. And it's that philosophy that also drives my leadership at the White House Project.
Excuse me, quote that again. If you want something,
That you've never had before, you're going to have to do something that you've never done before in order to get it.
I'm going to be sending that over Twitter.
Please do.
And quoting you, yes.
Yeah.
Tiffany, we're wrapping up, And are there any insights, words of advice that you'd like to share with our listeners, along with any upcoming events that you'd like them to be aware of?
Yes. The last thing that I would love to leave people with is the gift that my parents gave to me, which is that you are the most powerful change agent in your own leadership journey, and that you already have everything that you need inside of you in order to create the kind of impact that you want in the world. The White House Project is here just to help you create the conditions under which your own leadership can thrive, and we invite you to join us at thewhitehouseproject.org to learn more about Go Lead and Go Connect programming in your neck of the woods.
Perfect. Tiffany Dufu, president of the White House Project, incredible leader and influencer here in the world. Thank you so much for joining me, your host, Gail Sylvia at sylviaglobal.com.
Thanks, Gail.
We'll come back again.
Yes, anytime.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.